Hey everyone, welcome to Guards of Eden. Today's guest is Sophie Eggleton. This was a really lovely conversation, and I think it's a real testament to who Sophie is as a person, because I acknowledge it in the episode, which I don't know if I've ever done, and if I have, it's very rare. I acknowledge how at peace I feel in the conversation, which is really strange as kind of the host slash interviewer to acknowledge how comfortable I feel, but Sophie has this like really at peace kind of nature and a lovely just way about discussing her story, which starts off in the music industry, interviewing bands and artists. And we talk about a whole array of things in terms of the conversation of mental health when it comes to artists. And it just led to this beautiful conversation. Sophie has her own podcast called Play, Pause, Repeat, which I highly, highly recommend, and lives in the show notes. And Sophie's a woman of many talents. So you'll be able to find out a lot more about her story, not only in this conversation, but in the show notes, kind of through her social media platforms, the work that she's doing. She's open about a recent diagnosis of ADHD, which I found really interesting. The way that she describes her experience with it, and also just describes kind of the expected feedback that she got. It just leads to this conversation of like real kind of consciousness, I think, is like the word I want to lean on, in terms of both of us being highly present and both of us being just open about how we're feeling, being very much in the moment. So it's a conversation I can't wait for you guys to listen to. Once again, please go support Sophie through the show notes. And without further ado, 3, 2, 1, let's go. Hey Sophie, how are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. I love your I love everything you've got going on in the background. It's such a lovely background.
I should have tidied. I didn't even think about that. If I just swivel the laptop just about 5 inches, you'll see a lot of clutter and a lot of mess. I've just got a nice little window here of peace and quiet.
Oh God, I'm the exact same. We're literally like within an arm's distance of my bed, because this has been my COVID office for 3 years, two years. So
blimey.
Yeah, so trust me, I'm the exact same. I can go either way. You'd be like, wait, what's going on? But
I think creative types have a tendency towards mess, don't they? Like, you're more likely to have chaos around you because you've got ideas and things going on all the time that you need to get out there in some form, and it just creates mess.
And I like to call it organized chaos, I think, is another thing. It makes sense, even if it's only in my own head.
I think that's true, because people always say to me, how can you find anything? But I genuinely know where everything is. And when someone tidies it, that's when I can't find anything.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
I'm glad we're on the same page. This is going to go very well.
100%. I love this start. So the first question I had for you is one that I ask every guest, which is, I have a Spotify playlist called The Guards of Eden Soundtrack.
Yeah.
And it's a song, it's a playlist where each guest gives a song that either makes them happy or reminds them of a happy memory. So Sophie, can you give us a song that either makes you happy or reminds you of a happy time?
Well, the first thing that pops into my head, right, is the Labyrinth soundtrack.
Ooh.
So a song from there, and I don't know if I should go this way, but I used to have a big crush on David Bowie when I was a kid. He was probably my first crush.
I don't blame you.
Thank you. And Jareth, in those tight leggings in Labyrinth, I was quite confused because I was scared of him, but I also found him very alluring. Mm. So it was like early age confusion there. And there was this dream sequence where Jennifer Connelly got to dance with him. In a masquerade ball thing.
Yeah.
And there's a quite romantic song that he sings during that, which in hindsight is probably not right, because I think she was quite young, actually. Mm. but the song itself is lovely, and me thinking about David Bowie always makes me very happy. So I'm going to go with that one, which isn't an overtly happy song, but it's got, you know, nice early stage happy memories linked to it.
I like it. Well, that's going to live on the Spotify playlist, which is in the show notes. Thank you for your contribution.
No, thank you. Don't judge me, anyone, for my choice. If everyone's going, what, of all the songs in the world, why she picked that one? But it's just what came in, so I'm going with it.
It's yours. That's the thing, right? That's the main thing. Exactly. It's yours, which I love.
Okay, good.
I want to ask a really boring question firstly, which is probably not the best way to frame it, but how are you feeling being on the other side of the microphone as someone that has been the host slash presenter slash interviewer many, many times?
That's an interesting one. It's good in a way because it makes me understand how the people being interviewed feel. And the fact that you do have that worry of, have I answered that correctly? Have I answered that in a way that isn't going to offend people? Have I covered every point that I should cover with my answer? So I understand why people would feel, I guess, apprehensive about being interviewed now, which I think it's good to have that understanding of the other side of things. But in saying that, that does mean that I have some anxiety about it because I've already thought, should I have put that song? Did I say Bowie right, or are people going to say it's Bowie, Sophie? Why do you say it like that? And, you know, all these sorts of things have already come into my overthinking brain. But at the same time, it's really nice that I also don't have to remember things like I do when I'm an interviewer. Like, I don't have to remember the date that the album's due to come out, yes, or the band members' names, and, you know, whether they had a member that left that I shouldn't be mentioning because it was awkward, you know, all these things. I could actually just relax and have a natural conversation with you, which is lovely.
Yeah, because I had maybe recorded about 15 episodes when I first went on someone else's.
Yeah.
And they asked me it. And yeah, a bit like you, I was just like really honest. I was like, this is way more terrifying. But yeah, I guess it does give you a bit more empathy than insight that you maybe wouldn't have had otherwise. But I understand it.
And you and me, we talked about doing this episode ages ago.
Yeah.
And so I guess that delay in it actually happening has also heightened that level of overthinking. And I guess when I had a day free today, I was like, I'm going to email you because if I don't do it, the procrastination will continue and that buildup of anxiety will continue. So I'm just going to do it and get it done. Because I know as soon as we start, I'm going to feel relaxed and happy and you're going to put me at ease, which you have. Aww. And it's going to be a great thing. So sometimes you just need to bite the bullet, don't you? Otherwise, you overthink yourself out of doing stuff.
100%. And look, this has been very much worth the wait. I'm really happy this is happening. So,
oh, you're too kind.
I'm also going to, once again, I feel really bad, but this is another question that I'm not sure I would want to be asked.
Oh, God.
Because it's like, but you'll get so... I'm a massive fan of the TV show Ted Lasso. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah, cool.
So in the beginning of that episode, for people that don't know, Ted Lasso is an American football coach in college, and he comes over to England. By the way, his flat in the show is about a 3-minute walk from our office, which also endears me to that, like, even that. I'm like, oh my God, I've literally been here for like 6 years. It's there. And he asks the owner of the football club that he goes to work for in the Premier League playing coaching soccer, what's your first concert and what's your favourite concert? So I want to ask you, what's your first concert that you went to and what's your favourite? By favourite, I'm saying, once again, you can pick whatever strikes you, but it doesn't have to specifically be a concert. It could be someone you've seen at a festival and it was their set you enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I will... giving you time to think about it, I'll say mine.
Yeah, please.
My first, which will, I guess it will give my age away slash like people will get it, my first concert was Steps.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I've heard a Steps song in about 10 years since. I think I'm
I have. Sorry. They've had some new material out lately and I'm still a Steps stan. Is that what
people say? Oh, I love that.
Yes.
And I guess my favourite would be, I flip-flop between this because there is a couple, I loved, it was the third day of a festival and the closing act was Bastille.
Oh, okay.
And I think because I didn't listen to their music too much beforehand, but knew some, I was like really taken aback. So it's the kind of combination of being really surprised how good they were live and also just how good the performance was, but me not expecting it. So yeah, I'll say Bastille as a favourite.
I've got a good Bastille story. Well, it's not great. It's not great. I've built it up now, so it has to be good, but it isn't. But I will say with Bastille, so one of my jobs when I used to work at a clothing brand called Cheer Up Clothing was to get musical artists into the office to just do little acoustic things. And I'd been hearing little bits about this band Bastille. They hadn't blown up yet. So I managed to get them to come to our office and do a little acoustic session. So it was just them on our sofa and me filming it and my colleague Ed with Bastille. And to see them now playing these huge venues, it's like, wow, we just casually invited them down the office one day and they just came and met us in Surrey. And
they were so
lovely and down to earth. And I think they still are by the sounds of it. But yeah, it's amazing how quickly things change. You know, imagine if I said, come down the office now, I'd get laughed in the face, really, by their management. But so that was pretty cool. My first gig was, apart from Party in the Park, do you remember Capital FM used to do those big ones where they had loads of different artists?
Yep.
I used to go to those, but my first proper gig was Michael Jackson. Whoa. On the History Tour.
So what a great first episode I've ever seen.
I know. It was unreal, as you'd imagine. It was spectacular. And it's probably kind of hard to beat because of his iconic status, but also because of the production values, the dancing, just the songs themselves. Yeah. You know, you can't really have a bad set list when you're Michael Jackson. So, yeah, that's a pretty good first one.
I mean, it's about as good as it gets, surely, I'd imagine. I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
I'm a big Beyonce fan, so I'd maybe get...
Oh.
So that would maybe be there as well.
Yeah, I think I saw Beyonce at Party in the Park, actually.
Look at you.
Yeah, I found one. Sorry, I'm like...
I love this. I'm such a big fan.
I've been quite annoying, aren't I?
No, I love this. Truly, I truly love this. I get to live vicariously through you.
Yeah. I think my first kind of guitar-based one was actually Manic Street Preachers.
Okay, yeah.
Who I loved back in the day. I had quite an indie phase before I got into my kind of new metal phase. And I know a lot of people like, you can only really like alternative or rock or metal and you can't like indie as well, but I've always liked every genre of music. I've never wanted to be pigeonholed into anything. Like, I love Steps, for instance. Yeah. You know, put a Steps on and it makes you really happy, doesn't it? I still know the dance routines from my youth.
Oh, that is classic.
So, no, I think you just gotta, whatever your heart wants, give it to it, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I love that so much.
What was it? Sorry, what's the other question? Was it?
It was first concert and favourite concert.
I think Linkin Park playing Hybrid Theory at Download was pretty special.
Yeah.
Because that album, I think, just has a special place in many of our hearts. Yeah. Those of us that got into that scene, late 90s, early 2000s, that was just a trailblazing record, wasn't it? And it still holds up now. It still sounds great.
Yeah.
And obviously Chester's vocals live were so impressive at Download. And just the vibe in the crowd that day, everyone was just so excited to hear those songs in person.
Yeah.
So that's up there. But we'll stick with those, otherwise I'll waffle on for 5 hours.
I love it. My Linkin Park crossover, because it's not traditionally like my genre of music I'd go to, but yeah, I grew up as a massive wrestling fan growing up.
Oh yeah.
And they were always on promos at that time. It was like, they were on like the big, like they would do like the montage to like promote the event coming up, and they had a couple classics where it was like their music in the background, so you end up being, for me, like I hear Linkin Park and like all their like their music, and it takes me like right back to being like, I guess like teens, but like preteen, like really wrestling nerd, like just loving it. So yeah, although that crossover, like I'm not a massive rock or like indie alternative fan, there's like a, you know, the Venn diagram of like artists where they clash with something else that I'm really nerdy about, and that's like my way in.
What's your top crossover then? What's your go-to, your number one?
I was always a big, like, I loved garage music when I was growing up.
Me too.
Loved garage music.
Yeah.
And I had a, like, not a stepbrother, but kind of, because my dad's not married, but that was, like, getting into DJ at that time. And it's, like, for me, like, that era of garage music was just fun. And I loved it. And I was, like, old enough to appreciate it and go to under-18s discos. And it was, like, DJ Luck and MC Nee and all these different, like, songs being played.
Oh, the nostalgia, yeah.
Honestly, so it was, like, so my childhood was, like, a mixture of that and then, like, Sean Paul, early Rihanna.
Yeah.
Like, Rihanna was, like, my first, like, I was talking about the other day. Rihanna was, like, my first, I feel like, big, big crush. Like, celebrity crush, like, big one. Because she would have been, like, 16 and I was 14 when, like, Pond the Replay came out and it was the music video where she's going around the roller skating theater. And yeah, I just was saying, I was like, it was the first time I was like, oh my God, like, I didn't know what I was feeling, like, that confusion of it all. But so it was that, really, like, cheesy poppy R&B and garage, I think, were like my introductions. And then my mum's a massive Lauryn Hill fan. So that album got regularly played in my house when I was a child.
Great album, though.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, so appreciate it now. And my dad was like he was a big hip hop fan and, like, kind of reggae, kind of. So, yeah, it was like I got lucky in that sense. Like, a lot of that music is, like, somewhat in fashion in certain ways now.
Yeah.
So it ends up being a lot of the pop music, it kind of reminds me of, like, my childhood then, and I get to appreciate it now. So, yeah, that was my introduction, really.
It's so nice talking to someone that's got all these varied interests in different kinds of music, because when I was younger, I had a real hip-hop R&B phase as well. I used to love Busta Rhymes. Yep. I loved The Roots. Yep. I bought that Mystical album that everyone got at the time when he blew up, Ja Rule.
Oh my God, I love Ja Rule.
Yeah, I used to love him. And the Fugees, obviously. Yep. Also, when Nate Dogg was doing all the vocals and guesting on everything, and Mace and Nas. Yeah. And I had a real phase of that. And I just think it's so important that you just go with what your preferences are and don't worry about whether your image fits the scene or whether you fit the stereotypes. You just got to enjoy what you enjoy and do it 100% and go with the little evolutions of your music taste that come and go, and it makes it more fun.
That's really, like, I know you've done it unintentionally. That's really, like, profound and easily, like, correlates with, like, a life theory, I feel like. Like, yeah, I'm such a huge fan of that. And it all comes through something I love, which is music, which is a big reason for the Guards of Eden soundtrack. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, I do. I love hearing about it. It was something that I obviously know you through the prism, I guess, of, like, podcasting and mental health. But, like, being able to, like, go delve, like, deeper and see, like, this passion for music, like you said, it's just so nice to, like, talk about it with someone.
Yeah, because sometimes people, like, give you that look like, okay, you're geeking out a bit too much now. Rein it in, girl. Because I think, because I now know, because I've got ADHD, that perhaps I am not good at self-editing sometimes. And I can, if I'm passionate about something, sometimes probably I go a little bit too hard on it, to the point of ranting. Even with my blog posts and my podcast, you'll notice some of them are really long, and apparently it's very common for people with ADHD not to be able to edit things down and whittle them down. So at least I have an excuse for it now.
Yeah, 100%. And I do want to talk about that, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk about it now. You've mentioned
it. Okay.
So I read the blog on it that you wrote about talking about your diagnosis, and something that it stuck out to me, and it probably resonated with me because I would have probably felt the same / gone through a similar process. was that you had the diagnosis of being ADHD, which is, I believe it's newer of this year, right?
Yeah.
And you spoke about how quickly you transformed from, how quickly your mindset went from you processing the news to how are other people going to react and how am I going to have to deal with that? So the question I wanted to ask was, how did you find that really? And how challenging, I don't know if challenging, but how have you found the process of prioritizing your own health whilst also having to wrestle this idea like, oh God, like I've kind of got to brace myself really for like kind of a variety of like, I put in parentheses, like bad responses. And you provided some great examples that crossed my mind. I was like, I wonder what people would say. And you came up with a few and I was like, yeah, I can really envision it. So how do you prioritize that whilst kind of protecting yourself from like, oh God, oh God, oh God?
Yeah, it's a really hard one. And it's so frustrating with illnesses that are lacking understanding or lacking kind of worldwide accurate representation and understanding of, because you are constantly having to educate other people, bat certain false myths away, manage people's expectations of you, all this sort of stuff, when really you want to be putting all your energy into establishing this new chapter of your life post-diagnosis, where you can put all your energy into working out how you're going to live with this, how the knowledge of this diagnosis is going to improve your life, what you can learn from it, what things you can adapt to make your life easier. Yeah. But instead, you're always concerned with other people. And I imagine it depends on what type of person you are. If you are someone that's always very concerned about other people, making sure they're okay, or making sure that they like you or understand you, then it's going to be probably more stressful than for someone that's very much a water off a duck's back kind of mentality that can just crack on. I'm definitely on the warrior side of life, and I worry what people think of me. I worry about judgment, and I also want people to be okay and happy and not worry about me as well. So I don't have the answers to all that yet in terms of making sure that I'm focusing on myself. I'd say I'm still very much putting in energy to appease other people, and that's something I've got to work on, because like you say, I have had some of those reactions that I predicted and that my doctor would predicted that I would receive. And I'm glad she gave me that warning in a way, so it wasn't a disappointment. I was prepared and knew that was coming, but it doesn't stop it from being quite frustrating. And your mind also tells you that there's people probably saying stuff behind your back on top of that you're not even aware of, like, oh, that's a convenient excuse for why she's rubbish at messaging me back, or that's a convenient excuse why she's making spelling errors, or whatever, you know, it is. But really, I think I wish more people knew that no one would volunteer to fake illnesses or chronic conditions or, you know, diagnosis if they knew how hard it is to get diagnosis, how hard it is to get financial support and all these sort of things. There wouldn't be this narrative about, you know, fakers and benefits cheats, because if you've been through the system, you know how miserable and frustrating and long and difficult it is. And you also know about the stigma that still exists in society and within your social networks and within your family. So I think people that say that people are jumping on bandwagons because it's trendy at the moment, or, you know, that kind of thing, I think that makes it clear to me that they don't have an understanding of the reality of how it actually is. Because if they knew how much the symptoms that I have of ADHD that I didn't know were ADHD have impacted me in my adult life, they would know that I would have chosen to have had the diagnosis way earlier, so I could carved out a life that, I don't know, just suited me a lot better and didn't put me under so much stress for so many years doing things that involved me having to mask who I really was and hide things that I was finding really difficult. I've completely lost what the original question was, but it's difficult, but it's an ongoing process, and I'm sure it will get easier.
Yeah. Don't ever worry about what the original question was. You're in an answer, good. And I like it. But that does actually, like, I love this. It's like, yeah, I do. I love it. I've, like, asked the question that I planned last, and I love the where it's going. But, yeah, so something that really intrigues me about your answer there, the idea of feeling like you have to mask things that you've maybe struggled with in the past, and just, like, kind of the diagnosis kind of maybe freeing in that sense, but also an element of, like, I wish I'd known this years ago and I could have kind of, you know, maneuvered through my life with that knowledge. But something that I was curious about is, because you've spoken on other podcasts and you've spoken about being, well, introverted leaning. I know that I can't remember the term you gave, but it
ambivert.
Yeah.
But more introvert. Yeah.
I was wondering how were the early days of, because for those of the people that don't know about Sophie's career, that a large part of it has been music journalism based and interviewing bands. But it's an industry that I imagine is, like, very fast paced and very highly stimulating, right? Whether it's sound, like just hearing these bands live, or shows, all these different things. So I was wondering, how did you find being presented with that early on? What I can imagine is fast paced and highly stimulating. Mm. Just the environment alone, not alone the actual challenges of the job, which are socially, well, engaging and could be draining, I imagine. How did you find those early days? And what did you lean on to kind of, for self-preservation purposes, where you kind of protected your energy in that?
Yeah, oh, that's such a good question. And there's so many elements to that. So as you may have heard in other podcasts and stuff, it was never my goal to be a presenter, never my goal to be, you know, on camera or anything like that. As an introvert, I'm much happier just beavering away on projects, you know, quietly in my bedroom, you know. I started off just doing writing type music journalism, but obviously everything was going to the way of YouTube and visuals and content and all that sort of stuff. So all these jobs, they started wanting you to pivot to video. So being the people pleaser that I am, as people with ADHD often are, I was like, yeah, fine, I'll do that. So did it. And, you know, it's one of these things that just one thing leads to another, and then it ends up being, you know, one of the things that you're doing really regularly. And it did become easier the more regularly I did it, obviously, because you just get to know how it all goes and you get a bit more confident. But there was never a time where the nerves left me. Every time was a draining experience, and an experience that probably depleted way more energy than it would for someone that is neurotypical, perhaps, or someone that was extroverted. And little things like, you know, if someone last minute wanted to change the time of the interview or where it was or the details of what I had to ask, that would make me go into a spin in my head. But obviously I had to seem professional and like, oh, it's no problem, don't worry at all. Even though inside I was like, oh my God.
I'd be the exact same way.
Yeah, awful. And then you're also having, because I was a one woman band, I was bringing my tripod, my, you know, my microphone, my camera, and having to set that up in front of a band that are watching me do it. And then worrying about the technology failing, on top of trying to remember interview questions, on top of just being a human being and functioning and learning how to, you know, greet people in a normal way. And then I'm glad you mentioned the sound thing, because when I got what was ultimately what I always thought would be my dream job, which was doing the Download, being the main interviewer for their socials. I guess it just wasn't the happy experience that I wanted it to be, because where I was interviewing was in the press tent, which is full of all the other journalists and people recording things. And the noise in there was so overwhelming for me. I guess it would be loud for normal people, but for me, it was almost like there was a swarm of wasps in my head while I was trying to do interviews you know, and having to do that while managing, you know, vibrating phones in my pocket where the next band was calling me saying, we've arrived for the interview slot because we're running late. And it's just, you can't do the professional job that you want to do. So on top of that, you're then beating yourself up for not being as good as you really want to be. And also knowing that the YouTube community that will see the videos won't be aware of the environment and the situation that's happened around that interview. So you will be the first port of call if they don't like the interview and they just say, it's all because she's bad, rather than she was dealing with lots of noise or interruptions or a band that arrived at the wrong time or, you know, all these things. And Download are actually fantastic in terms of accessibility and trying to make things good for everyone, and really good for disability and inclusivity. They're fantastic. But in terms of me, that only works if I speak up and tell them, you know, what I need and what would help me. And one, it's not always possible to get all the things you need just because of budgets and logistics and things like that. But also, as a woman in the music industry, you feel like if you flag up any issues when you've got this job that, you know, a lot of people would kill for, you're not going to be back next year because you've complained, because you've been difficult, because you've vocalized something that isn't positive. So you've also got that in your head. So you can't advocate for yourself in the way that would make this dream job actually feel like the dream job you always thought it would be. And I, since then, because I've spoken about it a little bit on my YouTube videos about the difficulties I had with that weekend, I feel a huge sense of guilt as well, because I feel like some people might perceive that as being ungrateful or not realizing how lucky I was to get that job and all these sorts of things, when it's not about that at all. I really appreciated it. And I know that there's plenty of other people that could have done a fantastic job, better job than me, and I was lucky to get it. But I just want to talk honestly about how difficult these experiences can be for people that are have autism or ADHD or other things like that, or anxiety or social anxiety. You are there looking like you're functioning and masking and putting on this face like, I'm a professional, I know what I'm doing. But underneath it all, it's really hard work. And it's not over when the weekend's over. You've then got weeks of the overthinking and the anxiety that follows it, going, oh God, I can't believe I said that to Mark Hoppus. He's going to think I'm an idiot. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Or when I said that to my team, did they think I was being a diva? You know, all these sorts of things, which I'm not sure I would feel if I was a male in the music industry, and two, if I was neurotypical, and three, if I wasn't a people pleaser, you know? And the sound issue, like you said, I've been diagnosed with sensory sensitivity. And I've always...
I'm the same way, by the way.
Are you? Oh, we need to talk about this then, don't we?
Yeah, I very quickly, I read a book. I got recommended it by someone. It's, I believe her name's Dr. Elaine Aaron with one A. But it's called The Highly Sensitive Person, and she has a quiz in there, and it's like true or false. I think it's... I don't know if it's like 20... It might be 18 or 21 questions. They're just true or false. And it's like, if it's above 14, I think it is 21. And it was like, if it's above 14, you're highly sensitive or prone to be that way. Mm. And I think I either got to 17 or 18, I think. So yeah, same. And it explains like what that means. And yeah, but so yeah, that's the first thing that came to my head as someone, you said being introvert leaning but also neurodivergent, like I thought there's probably a potential that we would experience that the same in terms of the intensity of sound, how draining that is on the body, even if it's subconsciously or even if you are aware of it and you try to battle through it, by the time your body's like come down from the adrenaline of it, or you're like, Jesus Christ, I need to like just sit and be in a dark room, which I often do if I'm like hungover or just had like a social like weekend, I'm like, oh, I need to be in the dark and like left alone somewhat, like to just recharge.
Could I ask you then, Because I've come to the point now where if my group of friends say we're going to go to some like bars in London on Saturday, do you want to come? I now say no, because I know that me trying to hear them and listen to the, and concentrate on their conversations with that much background noise, it's just going to be not fun experience for me. And it's going to, I'm going to be zonked for the rest of the week after that. So do you still partake in those sort of social activities? Are you more mindful in terms of accepting invites to things?
So I do, but what will happen is over, I'd say, especially maybe the last 3 or 4 years, I will have to schedule a day afterwards. Like if it's a night in London, I will largely have the next day free and intentionally cancel plans. Intentionally, my whole personality screams like, yeah, leave him alone that day. And I will usually work out before any big social event that I have anxiety around. So I work for my family. So I work for my cousin. So if we have a work event, it will be dribs and drabs of family, his friends, and work. So I'm balancing all these dynamics. So if we have a work event like that, like it's almost like mandatory that I do some sort of physical exercise to settle my body down.
Right.
So then when I go in, I'm much calmer, my body's looser, all these different things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'll go in there and just feel the anxiety. So, yeah, I do partake in them, but there's usually some sort of planning on prior and after. At this point, like, I could pretend they're not, like, just compulsory, but they are kind of like an unspoken compulsory nature to it. But I like drinking. I think that's the big thing. If I wasn't a drinker, I think I'd probably... I wouldn't venture out in that way.
Right. So that lures you out, the alcohol and the,
the
hops.
Leave no good time behind kind of mentality. But once again, like, I can be anxious the day before, the day during, like certain things like that. I'm like, oh, like there's a bit of that energy into it. So
there ends up
being pre and post kind of plans to recover.
It's good that you know what works for you though in terms of doing the exercise and knowing to leave that gap of rest day afterwards. But what's difficult is when you have a lifestyle or schedule that doesn't allow for you to do those things, and so often we're stretched so far across so many things that we can't implement those things even though we know that's what we need to do. And I think that's where, you know, employees and your friends and loved ones being flexible and allowing those adaptations is so important. Like when I got my diagnosis, they've given me lots of paperwork that if I have a boss that I can send to them, that give them information on how they can make work suit my brain, I guess, and things that would be helpful to me, like allow me if I'm in the hyper-focus mode, you know, that I can... you know, work at those hours instead of the hours that they're telling me are the work hours, because they might be asking me to work at a time when I'm in my distracted, you know, phase of the day and just can't get anything done. So, are you good at telling people in your life?
No.
I'm going into the interview mode again.
And I love it. It's, I'm more than happy to answer. So no, in all honesty, it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
And I think that's where another thing that we're similar at, you've mentioned before, like being kind of non-confrontational by nature, if I remember correctly. I'm the exact same. So what it ends up being is that now I'm working on, like I say it openly that I'm in therapy and have rejoined. I started at about 23, did 3 years, then off. Then pandemic off. So I'm back. And yeah, that's like the big thing I'm working on at the moment. The idea of how do I like prioritize voicing how I feel with people in my life?
Yeah.
Because yeah, being non-confrontational, it leads to this, like for me anyway, it leads to, I just would rather not get into it.
Yeah.
Can I put a brave face on long enough? to just kind of front the uncomfortableness and the kind of boundaries being breached that are in my own head that no one knows, and just be like, kind of brace, and then try your best to like let it go. But so yeah, to answer your question, not really. It's something I'm really working on in kind of my immediate present, I guess.
How about
you?
Yeah, it's so difficult. There's things that come up regularly in my life where I would like a bit more support from certain people in my life. But when you voiced it so many times, there comes to a point where, like, I can't keep saying the same thing over and over again because it's driving me mad. And clearly my words aren't having any kind of impact here. So do I continue to tire myself out saying the same thing over and over to the people that clearly aren't receptive to it? Or do I just accept that's the way it is and just work on other things in my life that I can control and can do things about? But it's hard because I never know where the line is on whether you should actually be like, it's not cool that they're not listening to you. So maybe you should consider whether they should be a significant part of your life, or whether you should just go, hey, we're all different. We all have our strengths. We all have different views. And maybe it's okay that we're on different pages. It's a hard line to sometimes find with that. But I think as you get older, you know, you tend to drift away from certain people naturally anyway, because you just have, I don't know, different focuses, different wavelengths, things change and you evolve differently. And I think sometimes naturally those people kind of gradually dissolve out your life a little bit naturally anyway. So maybe sometimes you don't have to worry about that very definite decision making process. It will kind of naturally happen as you just tend to gravitate towards them less because you don't feel you're in sync anymore.
And the relationship between you evolves or into whatever it evolves into. And I'm a lot like that too, in terms of just allowing a course to take place and just learning to like be at peace with like that idea of some people don't understand, and then some people just have an unwillingness to even try, I guess. It's challenging. Like, I've got friends of like over 10 years that like they still I don't know really. They kind of, like, I'm like very flaky, I think, in that sense, with plans. Like, I'll happily go, yeah, I'll do it. And then something will happen. I'll be like, no, I haven't got it in me.
Yeah.
But then, you're dismissed as flaky, but no one ever questions, like, oh, I wonder why, like, why go through those ebbs and flows emotionally, I guess. So, yeah. And some people don't understand, like, alone time. How important that is. So it's challenging. But like you said, I think some people it just dissolves, doesn't it, in certain ways.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? We throw around that flaky description all the time, don't we? If you've got that mate that, you know, never turns up or tends to back out last minute. But you're so right. There's usually a very valid reason behind these things. It's very rarely someone just going, no, I can't be asked. It will be because they're feeling anxious about something, or they've depleted their energy doing something that week. They need that alone time to recharge. Or perhaps there's a dynamic at home that's making it difficult for them to leave. You know, someone making them feel guilty about going out because they, you know, there's so many reasons. And it's a shame we quickly go to that, oh, they're just a crap friend kind of thing.
Yeah.
When there's so many very potentially deep things going on that will impact someone's willingness to leave the house and be sociable and be vibrant and present and, you know.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, I'm not a little bit all or nothing, but it's rare I'll go to an event and not be able to be on form somewhat. So, maybe it's like maybe over time I've learned to just know that if I do go, I'm going to be on bad form, and if not and I'm in good mood, then I'll be like an addition to whatever party or whatever. But yeah, it's I also, I'm the king of leaving things early.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. And Irish goodbyes, and where I'm like, oh, I can't be bothered to go and say goodbye to like 20 people.
No, stealth it. Just slink out there.
Yeah, I'm like the king of it. So, yeah, I guess the funny thing is that building that reputation as being that person, it dissipates the reaction from people now, which is like a bit of a bonus.
That is good.
It's like a bit par for the course. Of like, oh, actually, that's probably, that's very much what he's like, so.
Oh, that's so him.
Yeah, just like, let us know you get home safely. But like, yeah, so there's a couple of things that I do maybe that if I'm at something and I'm, I guess the tolerance for being somewhere unhappy, it's like very low. I'd rather just be like, yeah, bye. So.
Yeah. Or sometimes you go to things because there is that obligation feeling, isn't it? But you want to show some willing and effort, but you also know if you stay there any longer than that time that you can cope with, that you're not going to bring anything to the party, like you say, and it is better off for everyone if you do slink out at that time.
Yeah.
And you feel like, okay, I've done my bit, I've done enough there. And sometimes that I prefer to do that, because sometimes I do have that guilt of letting people down if I don't go to things. So if I can just show my face, I try to do that. But in recent times, I've just been so drained. I haven't even been able to do that, really. And you just always hope people know that it's never personal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it's just, managing and maintaining certain health things that you're doing, which you'd hope that they would want you to do.
Yeah, you'd like to think so, for sure. Yeah, I completely agree. One thing that we do have in common that I don't even know if you know this, but I do, obviously. We both went to Southampton Solent.
Oh, okay.
So
did you study?
I studied fitness management and personal training.
Right.
And I had the polar opposite of your finale, which was you finished with, I believe, first class honours, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And I dropped out.
Yeah, but like, has getting a first class degree helped me in any way? Absolutely not.
but yeah, we both went there. And I wanted to know, what was your experience in Southampton? How did you find it? And how did you find moving away? Because I'm assuming, well, I don't know if you were born and raised where you are, but I'm assuming you moved from somewhere to there.
Yeah, so I've grown up in Surrey, which is where I reside now. So Southampton was about an hour away, which for me was good because it was a whole new city. It was far enough away that you didn't feel like you might bump into your parents but if you needed anything from home, they could drive it up to you and they could visit you on the weekends and stuff like that. So it was, for me, it was a really good balance. And for me, the best thing about uni was that independence that you finally feel. You're a young adult and you're doing your own food shop. You're going to Asda and getting everything in bulk, getting potato waffles. You're eating all the stuff that your parents would say, no, that's not very healthy. You're not having that. You just pile all the things that you were always told were bad for you, not good. You're finally like, yes. And Asda actually became like a really fun trip with the housemates every week. We'd actually look forward to going to Asda.
That Asda in Southampton is massive as well.
Isn't it?
It's huge.
Like a theme park. It was incredible. So I love the independence side of it. I love that, you had your own schedule, you just felt like, oh, I'm a grown-up. Yeah. That's really cool. And I love that everything in Southampton was walkable, really. Mm. Like, if I wanted to go, like, proper shopping, I could walk into town. If I wanted to go to the gym, if I wanted to go to the charity shops and find bargains, if I wanted a kebab, everything was on your doorstep. And this, I loved that. And that's something I miss now because, obviously, usually you have to get in cars when you're in the suburbs to go to everything you need. But in uni towns, everything's just right there, which is dangerous for your waistline and your bank balance. But, it's great. Uni was a very mixed bag for me. I had some dreadful times at uni, but I had some very fun things. But I definitely grew up a lot, and I think that's what uni does. They always say university of life, don't they?
Yeah.
And that's what those 3 years were. It was, fully becoming that independent adult that I'd always craved to be.
I wanted to ask you about your time as a podcaster too. So, naturally, you had spoken, you'd interviewed people in these other settings, and then you built your own podcast.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you what drew you to podcasting, and then what drew you to podcasting in general, and then what drew you to starting your own podcast with your co-host Kelly, and then beginning Play, Pause, Repeat podcast. That's almost a tongue twister for me anyway.
Yeah, but sorry about that.
No, it's fine. I was like, cool. I was like, please get it right. But yeah, so what leads to your general interest in coming into podcasting?
Yeah.
And then actually, like, what leads you to forming your own, and how have you found that experience too?
I suspect you have an idea of why I might have been more drawn to podcasting than on camera stuff. So obviously that had an appeal, the fact that, you know, it feels somewhat safer and less exposing when it's, obviously you're sharing a lot because it's your voice and your thoughts and your opinions and stuff, but the fact that it wasn't about image or, you know, the superficial stuff, I found quite appealing. And I'd also done a bit of radio. I'd been on Alex Baker's show on Kerrang as a guest a few times, just talking about like topics, and on Hoxton Radio. And I really always liked that to and fro, that conversational thing of going in deep on topics. I've always loved that. That's why I'm enjoying talking to you. I really like, you know, delving into things and dissecting and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So the ability to do something long form was really appealing to me, because, you know, these days they want everything snappy and, you know, fast paced, and, you know, because everyone's attention spans are so short because of social media, you want like 10 second sound bites and stuff, which I don't think is my thing. So that was appealing. But I also knew that if I didn't do it with someone else, I would never post it. It would be a secret podcast with only one listener. Because I'm not very good at putting myself out there and kind of championing myself and, you know, I guess being my own cheerleader. I've always struggled with that. Yeah. But I thought if I do it with Kelly, who is a great friend, who is really good at, I don't know, pushing you to be proud of yourself and pushing yourself to be your best version, I guess. And I thought she will be a great partner, and she will almost be an accountability buddy in that, you know, if there's someone else, she'll be like, we've got to post this episode today, so or we've got to record this. So I knew that would mean it would actually go live rather than just be another idea that I've got that I've shelved for years. I think for me and Kelly, because before that we were friends that were really close, but we'd only actually catch up every few months. With the podcast, it meant we were catching up every week. And it was really like, it became a really nourishing friendship to have that someone that was checking in with you every week. And we were having these deep conversations. It was a bit like casual therapy in a way. And it really strengthened our bond. And I think actually we're both missing that now we're on a hiatus from the podcast. And we're struggling to find time now to catch up, because that became like a regimented thing. But as soon as that's gone, we're back to the chaos that is our lives again. And it's and it's hard to squeeze things in, but hopefully we'll get back there again.
Yeah, look, you're talking to someone where this is my, this is the longest break between episodes, the one I last recorded and this one.
Oh, right.
So the exact same in terms of, and I don't know about you, actually, I'll be intrigued to see what you think, but I think when I first started the podcast, I had the benefit of like, it's the first time I've ever done it. So in my head, I was like, I'll just get better at it by doing it more. And it doesn't matter if it's not great at the beginning, whatever. But because I have this mini track record and I've set myself mini standards, there was this element of like, oh, fuck, like, what if I can't do it as good anymore? Or what if I struggle to like get the rhythm back and all these different things? Like I had this weird like imposter syndrome I'd never had, and like all these fears that you'd expect having right at the beginning. Just taking like a little bit longer between seasons, and all of a sudden I was like, oh shit, like what if I struggle with this and this and this?
Totally relate.
So yeah, it's so yeah, I really like, it's strange you've said that about the hiatus. I'm really like feeling so similar about it.
But you seem very natural and at ease, and there's momentum. It doesn't feel like it, yeah. It doesn't feel stuttering or like, so you're back in the swing of things fine, aren't you?
Well, this is like, you've said it about feeling at peace, like talking to me. I feel like the exact same. Like, this is a really lovely episode to be recording. I wouldn't usually be that present in like, oh God, this conversation, this. I kind of would reflect after the fact, but yeah, now you've said it, I have. I'm loving talking to you. Don't want to use a past tense, but but no, I have. So it probably helps that it's gone the way it has, like it has. But yeah, I don't know really. I had these like feelings I'd never had in like 3 years of doing it. I was like, these weird like self expectations that no one probably else has.
Yeah. And don't you feel like that's half the battle all the time? Is it's the voices in our head. It's never usually anyone else. It's just those doubting voices that we give them a chance to return, don't we? And then,
yeah. So I completely agree. And how are you feeling about returning from the hiatus? It's just struck me. I was like, yeah, what kind of, where's your head at with what the next phase is?
I really miss doing interviews, actually. It's hard because, like I was talking about download earlier, I love talking to bands and I love conversations with them. So if there's a way to do that in a way that would suit me better, I would 100% still be doing it. So it maybe the podcast is the way that I can start doing that again in a way that suits me a bit better. But then there's that fear that you've left it so long now that you're not relevant. And you know, the managers and PRs are like, we're not giving you interview time with this band. You've been out of the system for too long.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so that's an extra worry now. And also, I don't know if you've noticed this now, but podcasting is now becoming a thing where you're expected to do live podcasts.
Yeah.
And you're almost a celebrity in itself for hosting a podcast, and that's not what I want, which I know is silly because you should want to be as successful as you can be at what you do. But the whole reason I like podcasts is because you're a bit more under the radar and a bit more reclusive with it. Yeah. So again, I feel like that self-sabotage coming in where I'm like, I don't want to do a podcast that does well in case it leads to those things that I don't want, even though those things are a sign that it's doing well.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a really hard thing to get your head around.
Yeah, I've had to reshape it, I think. I think it's so easy to get sucked into metric-based success.
Yeah.
Like, if I get this many listens, it's successful. And yeah, I've had to learn, for me anyway, a big determiner of success is primarily it's like the guest's reaction to the episode. For me anyway, it's like the best way to start. If they enjoy it, I'm cool with it. Like immediately off the bat, if that's the way it is, that's it. And then I guess guest numbers for me is like become the big thing. Like how many guests can I speak to? How many different stories can I share? Because I guess the difference is that you'll have solo episodes of Kelly and you'll have interview ones, right? Whereas I don't know if I don't quite think I'm interesting enough, or maybe I have too much self-awareness to just go, here we go, 40 minutes of me, boom, let's go.
I'd listen to 40 minutes of you. I would.
That's really kind.
I definitely would. And I think it all depends on whether you're talking about something you're passionate about and you're being your authentic self. I think as long as you're authentic, even if you only get two people wanting to listen to it, at least you know what you've put out there is true and, you know, what you want out in the world. And I think that's fine.
Well, thank you firstly, because that's a very kind comment. Like you really, like video, I just can't get my head around, I can't get used to it yet myself on video. But this has been like a perfect middle ground in terms of like doing something that scratches that curiosity and the creativity itch, but not being the center of attention with it. And that being like not from even insecurities, like an actual just lack of wanting to be the center of attention.
Yeah.
Like just being comfortable, like you said, having cool conversations and knowing that that's the main character in it all.
That's such an interesting point you've made there, because people, I think there's a line between whether you're a presenter or an interviewer, because for me, I'd often be called a presenter, but for me, I wasn't a presenter, because for me, that's more about you being a personality and being, you know, holding fort and that sort of thing. Whereas for me, I just wanted to facilitate the other person in a way, or say enough to get them talking.
Exact same.
But when you get the job of the presenter, they want you to be this really outgoing person that can do these intros,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
these
yeah.
really bubbly intros. And that stuff I really struggle with, because that wasn't really my thing. I like just getting, you know, just conversing with someone.
Yeah.
So I think there is a difference, isn't there?
100%. Yeah, I guess presenting, you feel like you're a big part of the show.
Yeah.
Whereas an interviewer, I don't know really. It's like, well, you're judged by like how much you can open a guest up and how
you can
evoke a reaction in that way. Whereas as a presenter, the guest almost, I don't know, I don't think they become secondary, but they become like kind of just like an ancillary kind of part of whatever's happening. But
I think it's a very different skill as well. Like some of my favorite TV presenters who are funny, who are outgoing, who like are really engaging, aren't actually good at interviews sometimes.
Yep.
And I think sometimes they give these presenters that are really good at what they do these interview jobs, and then you're like, oh God, this interview is actually quite painful.
Or podcast hosts. Like they become, you're like, oh God, you're great on TV, but like as a podcast host, I like... Like you said, it's just not that good. But and that's why, well, I don't know how you feel, but like that's why I'm a big Fern Cotton fan, because she's, in my head, she's very good at both.
I love Fern Cotton. I think I really respect how she's pivoted her career in the last few years, and she's decided to leave the stuff that wasn't serving her anymore, that wasn't making her happy, and going, you know, doing stuff that she clearly loves doing and feels comfortable doing. I just feel like she's blossomed, like, and it's great to see someone coming into their own in, you know, at 40. And yeah. I hate this whole thing that, you know, it's all about 20s, 30s. No, you can find your sweet spot at any age, and it doesn't matter how long it takes, you know, just keep going till you find that balance that just sits so well with you. And she's such a good example of that.
Yeah, I agree with you on what you've said. And yeah, I just think she's sensational at both, and a great representation of, you can see when she's engaging as one or the other.
Yeah.
Rather than just being Fern.
Yeah.
You can see that she's like, there's subtleties in the way she goes about things, where she can be Fern the presenter and Fern the interviewer and be equally as talented as both. So, and yeah, like you said, like this kind of, she's been on TV for years and all of a sudden has had this like career change and like taken to it like a kind of a duck to water, really. It's incredible.
Yeah, she's smashing it. Go on, Fern.
100%. I'm always here for a Fern shout out. I'm going to ask you a really selfish question.
Oh, go on then.
I'm going to try and frame it in a way that a listener can take value from, but this secretly, I'm just being transparent. Yeah, I really want to know this. So,
okay, I'm braced. Come on.
So, being someone that has been an interviewer for like a prolonged period of time, if you could give someone a piece of advice as a way to improve as an interviewer, or this is where it becomes less selfish. Someone that has to engage in conversation for a living. So that can be a manager, someone that works in a sociable job. What would be a piece of advice that you'd give to someone who either steers conversations or is an interviewer, is a way to focus on improving?
Right. The first one's going to be a super obvious one. Obviously, do your research, because it shows some respect for the person that's given time to you. And they will have had, no doubt, so many interviews with the generic questions. If you can find a few ones that they haven't heard before, you will see their face light up. They'll be so excited that they can say, say something else, that other words can come out of their mouth. And they really appreciate that you've put in the effort. So that's an obvious one. And the next one is just willing to adapt during the process according to the body language and the signs that they're giving you about how they're feeling. You know, if they're feeling hungover or they're feeling quiet, you know, ease them in, be gentle to start off with, make them feel relaxed, and use your body language and your face to express that you're not here to get a damning sound bite out of them, that you're not here to do the dirty on them, that you're just here for a nice chat. And just remember that they're human beings as well. I think that's so important, because I think sometimes we're like, they are an idol, a musician, you know, on this pedestal. But, you know, they fart, they have bad breath, they sweat, they have all the same things we do. And they're just people with feelings and moods and opinions and stuff. And just, one, not take things to heart if it doesn't go well, because it might be nothing to do with you. And just think of them as a human. I guarantee that will help it flow and just be a conversation rather than an interview. But a caveat to that is sometimes when you are doing an interview for a client, you have set questions, and that can be really difficult, because for me, one of the best things is when you go off piste and when you can go off on tangents and you just go with what is naturally coming out. But sometimes you're not allowed to do that, or you know those bits are going to get cut out, so it's almost pointless to allow those to happen. So that is tricky. But yeah, I just enjoy the weird natural weirdness that comes out of the chat, I guess. I don't know, is that enough answers?
It is. It's a great answer. This is a little insight to me. I'll always step really far away from the mic if it's an answer that I don't want to accidentally interrupt by like an ad lib of some sort.
Oh.
So what you've seen and no one else has seen is that I've been like very much microphone away.
Interesting. So that's a very physical action that you do there to...
Yeah. I've done it before where I've turned my mic off if I know it's a story that I'm... And it's just like a conscious way of me being... Because otherwise I'd be like, oh yeah, or something to disrupt. So yeah, it's... No, I love that answer. I did. I promise.
Okay. I'll probably think of something later that I wish I'd said, but hopefully there's something helpful in there.
No, 100%. This is something that's very new.
Mm-hmm.
I did it by accident at the end of my last season 4. So there's been 2 episodes.
Right.
It's where I say a bunch of very nice things that I've learned during prepping for the interview, but I allow that to be a part of the next question. But it basically allows me to say a bunch of things that are on my mind and some things that that I've just really respected through learning about your journey prior to our conversation.
Oh, Christ. Do I need a pillow to hide my face at this point?
No, I hope not. But yeah, I haven't got a name for it, but it's just something that I've enjoyed doing, and it allows me to verbalize really like what I've really appreciated from learning about your story. So here it goes. I believe the fact that you create a life where you do many things for many people is a testament to a combination of your natural curiosity as well as the courage to give things a go. Your honesty with your journey and who you are as a person is something I really admire. My respect for you continues to grow as I learn more and more about you, which is true in this conversation as well. Do you allow yourself the opportunity to reflect on what you've achieved, not only through your career, the career that you've built, but also I imagine the self-confidence and self-acceptance with who you are publicly and maybe even privately in your everyday life too?
You've actually made me cry.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, that was so nice. Thank you.
No problem. But,
God. Sorry.
No, that's okay. It's true though. It is.
Oh. When I had my ADHD assessment, and actually when I've had my therapy, a big theme is lack of confidence and self-esteem. So when people say things that make me feel that, I guess, sometimes I think like I've wasted some opportunities or wasted some years. So when people say that what I do has value, I guess it means quite a lot.
Yeah.
And what you did there was such a lovely thing, because I don't think we do it enough. I think we're very quick to complain about things sometimes, and we don't often tell people when we actually think that they're doing something positive or doing something nice. And I think the world would be such a nice place if out of the blue we just messaged the people in our lives, or strangers, and said, you know, I think that was great, or I love that you do that, or just, I don't know, just any little positive little nugget that you can send over. I just think it could change someone's day, and you've changed my day today. So thank you.
That's so nice to hear. And it's true though. So we spoke briefly before off mic, but talking about the idea of like, well, the whole reason you're on here is because I want to talk to you, right? It's very intentional. So there's a reason I'm speaking to you and have wanted to speak to you. And well, that's a big one. It's like, we haven't even covered it. We've had this such a great conversation. I've been such a bad like promoter of the work that you do, but but like the idea of like you training to work in, I believe it's like a mental health aid worker, right? In
A first aid mental health instructor.
Yeah. That working as an interviewer, a podcaster, a blogger, all these different hats that you wear, but yeah, and they do bring incredible value. So I did want to shine a light on that. And once again, that question. So do you allow yourself that opportunity to reflect on what you've achieved? And do you allow yourself to reflect on the personal journey you've gone through, the idea of being able to, I don't know if it's be more self-confident and more self-accepting, but the idea of being more really like authentically you / verbalizing, you know, the battles that you have with your health, or I guess, well, the neurodivergency is like a new one, but the idea of like, do you allow yourself to reflect upon like the evolution over that time?
In the past, I'd say probably I haven't enough. I think because I think we spend so much of our life chasing things, don't we? We're on this quest for better, bigger, more success, more notoriety, whatever it is, that we don't take a moment to think of all the things we've done. And I think I've been very guilty of that. And I actually think getting my ADHD diagnosis was a really good way to put a spotlight on that, because I realized that all these things that I've been beating myself up about that perhaps didn't go to plan or didn't lead to things that perhaps I thought should have, that should have catapulted me in some way to greater levels of whatever. I realized that it was quite good that I even managed to do what I did do, that I've managed to do all these things that were so clearly out of my comfort zone for so many years. So I did take a moment, and my mum made sure I did, because she pointed that out, and I realized that I may not have had the career that I thought I'd have, but I've done some really fun, cool things in my life that I will look back on with hindsight and go, wow, that's pretty cool that happened. But maybe in the moment, because I was feeling so much pressure and anxiety about it, I wasn't able to really enjoy it in the moment. So maybe now, with the knowledge I have about who I am and what I've been dealing with for so long, I can reflect with a bit more positivity and, you know, perhaps start being a bit kinder to myself and say, well, you got through that. You may not have smashed it, but you got through it. And that is actually an achievement in itself. So give yourself the props for that. So maybe moving forward, you'll see me being a bit better at that. I don't know.
I've got four questions, but I would like to ask you to plug shamelessly anything that you have going on, or any way that people can keep in contact. But you can do it. You can say, this is the best way to maybe keep up to date or engage with me in some way, but in the way that you're happy to, and whatever you're happy to plug, but no shame, shamelessly plug.
Okay, so my main Instagram, which is just a mixture of life, really, that you'll get a bit of mental health, you'll get a bit of fashion, a bit of dogs, home life, but of, you know, a bit of everything, is at Sophie Eggleton, one word. And that's probably where I communicate most on, I'd say, these days, although I'm not always great on the DMs. I try my best, but I'm not always great. And then if you're into DIY and a woman doing DIY stuff herself and decorating and all that kind of stuff, go to At Home with Egg. So that's I really enjoy that stuff. It feels a little, that's my safe place on Instagram because it's less about me and more about wallpaper. hopefully my podcast Play Pause Repeat will be back. So if you like music and chatting about life, that might be one for you. Mm. Yeah, and if you ever just want to chat about, you know, anything related to chronic health conditions, ADHD, mental health, I'm always here. So, you know, I'm not a professional psychiatrist or anything like that. So I can't give you official medical advice, but I can give you tips on how to support people through mental health issues and stuff like that. I am trained in that kind of stuff. So please, if you've got any questions, do feel free to pop me a message and I'll get back to you.
Awesome. All of that, guys, lives in the show notes. So please go and check Sophie out and please check out the podcast. So these are the final four questions. They're four questions that I just love asking, really, in all honesty. One is brand new to our episode.
All right.
But three of them, I'm not going to say I've put people through answering them, but they're three questions I ask everyone. But,
right, okay.
But to start off, question one, if I was to give you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could only share one message, what would it be?
To listen without judgment.
Very good. I like that a lot. I like that a lot.
Oh, that was, I felt under pressure. Like, what is going to come out of my mouth now? Yeah. Everyone eat chocolate.
That's also a good option. I'm going to take it as a secondary one. No, I love it. So, and number two, what are three personality traits / characteristics that you'd say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Oh, God. Should they be good or bad or a mixture?
Can be whatever you want, in all honesty.
Curiosity.
Good one. I like it.
Resilience.
Mm-hmm.
clumsiness.
Oh, I like it. Oh.
I'm all over the shop, really.
Oh, I
love always
it.
Covered in bruises, dropping stuff, spilling things, you know.
Oh, I love it. Oh, they're awesome. Thank you. They're great.
What are yours, by the way?
Do you know what the tremendous irony is that I've asked that question, well, double digit amount of times. And I never think of my own answers as dumb as it sounds.
Now is the time. So I do a countdown. Put you under pressure.
Oh, you get the countdown music. No, I curiosity is one. Actually, I'm not nicking it. I would say
cheating.
I know. I was gonna pick a synonym of some sort and pretend I wasn't, but it's the truth. Curiosity is definitely one. Compassion.
Oh, good one.
I think. Yeah.
Oh, I wish I... Yeah, anyway, can't have four.
You could swap out clumsiness. and then we've nicked one off each other. Curiosity, compassion. Yeah, it's a lot of the same stuff. I was thinking like kindness, empathy.
Empathy's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Oh, I'm not sure. So curiosity, compassion. And then I will end up on sensitive. I'm really sensitive, so I think I would, that would be the three I would say my life is built upon. So that would be my three, and you're the first person that's ever asked me it, so that's an exclusive, as it were, a Guards of Eden exclusive.
Be in the sun tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Host of podcast doesn't know how to answer his own question.
He's so sensitive, though.
Yeah, so sensitive. This is the new question.
Okay.
So,
I'm excited.
Yeah. I would like for you to take a second to picture this. And Sophie, if you'd like to close your eyes to help, but then that would be up to you. So, Sophie, you walk into a room. You see a table with two chairs.
Mm.
Seated in one of them is an 18-year-old version of yourself. you take the other seat and you're informed that you can tell your 18-year-old self one message before they go back to their everyday life. What would you want to tell them, and how do you think it would have impacted you to hear that from your current version of yourself?
I think I'd say don't worry about societal timelines. Mm-hmm. Just go with the flow. I don't know about you. When I was younger, I thought certain things would happen by certain ages, and just literally none of them happened. 100%. And I think if I use that as a benchmark of how successful I have been as a human, I would be depressed the whole time. Whereas if I just said, well, that's not how my life was meant to go, I'm doing things in my own way, then I'd feel a lot more content and happy life. So I think just don't be restricted by rigid rules and plans and, you know, timelines, because you're going to be self-limiting then. Just let things evolve naturally and you'll be all right.
I love it. That's such a great answer. Thank you.
Okay.
And you're the first person to answer that.
Yay!
This is my favorite question.
Okay.
Many years into the future, your time as Sophie Eggleton is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has one sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
You tried your best, I guess, because, yeah, I think that's all we can ever do, isn't it? And I think I would, being someone that wants to know that I tried my best for other people and tried my best to be a good human, I think I would go at peace then. And I think everyone's dream is to go at peace, isn't it?
I don't know. It is for me. I can't speak for everyone else. It's very much that case for me.
Yeah, and to know, but then being a people pleaser, I probably want them to go, yeah, you did. like, don't worry, you really did try your best. And then I might be like, oh, good. Night, night, kind of thing.
I love that. That's such a nice answer. Sophie, thank you so much. This has been truly, truly incredible. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed it too. Thank you so much. I felt like I've got a lot out of this chat, actually. I felt like actually I needed it and I didn't realise I needed it. So thank you.
Yeah, all from you taking a leap of faith and saying, I've got some time tomorrow. I was like, yeah. Okay, let's do it. Oh, thank you so much. People, please go check out the show notes. Check out what Sophie's got going on. And this will be me and Sophie signing off. So goodbye, everyone.
Bye. Take care, everyone.